Hi, my name is Kate, and I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups from Santa Fe, New Mexico. And this has already been an amazing weekend for me. I have absolutely the most thoughtful hosts, and everyone has taken some time this weekend to visit with me and let me get to know you a little bit better and share with me your stories. And it's so nice to get to this point and look out and realize, oh, I'm among friends. I always forget that. Yesterday I called my mom saying, oh, I'm having that first day at camp feeling, you know? I don't know anyone and they probably won't like me. Tom is absolutely one of my heroes in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'm also very privileged to be here this weekend and get to spend some time with him. I sort of have my five greatest recovering alcoholics, and he's one of them. I'll let you know the rest afterwards. But I'm just going to take a moment to do a quick set-aside prayer. God, help me to set aside everything that I know and everything I think I know about myself, you, and the people in this room so that I can have a new experience of you in my life. Thank you for this opportunity to be of service to you and my fellow man, and help me to be an agent of your will rather than my own. Amen. So, I actually want to read something. I've never done this before, but I was struck as I was visiting with people this weekend and talking a little bit about what the last year or two has been like with me. And this is from our Al-Anon literature. It's from a book called From Survival to Recovery. And I've actually only ever read two pages in this book, but they stuck with me. And I happened to mention to an Al-Anon if anybody had it handy, and I think within 20 minutes I got a tap on my shoulder and somebody had the book. You know, it's nothing like an Al-Anon with a job to do. So, talks about what it's like growing up in an alcoholic home. What is it like? It's unremitting fear. Fear of rejection, fear of the unknown, fear of being known. A constant nagging fear that never goes away. It's lonely. It's wanting so desperately to be apart, and yet pushing people so far away that I couldn't possibly be connected. It's isolating myself and then being the outsider looking in and never fitting in. I'm often ashamed. I'm afraid to lose the only people who say they love me. I'm afraid they won't come back, and then I'm afraid they will. It's confusing. People say they love me, and then they hurt me. In my gut, I know that something is wrong, but I'm told I overreact, or I'm too sensitive. So I learn not to trust my instincts. It's being needy. It's being convinced that I am unloved and unlovable. It's needing to hear over and over, you're wonderful, and yet never believing it. So I always need to hear it again, and it's still not enough. It's feeling that I am not enough. It's having to do for others so that I can earn their love, and yet feeling that what I give is never enough. It's about trust. It's being told I didn't see what I just saw, and believing other people instead of believing my own eyes. It's never being able to trust anyone, not even myself, because my whole life is based on pretense and denial of reality. And I don't even know what I feel about it. I think that came back to me this week because I had kind of an episode at work. I've had many miracles in recovery, and I hope that I get a chance to share a lot of them with you today. And one is my current profession. But I was busy working at my desk completely in my own world. And one of the people I work with, as a joke, burst into the room screaming. And I leapt out of my chair like I was under attack and saw who it was, saw that he was smiling, readjusted my expectations about what had just happened and what was about to happen. And the miracle of Al-Anon is I just took a moment. And I sat there, took several deep breaths, and I felt the trembling, And I realized I wasn't okay, and that I'd be okay. And I knew I hadn't actually been in danger, but that's not okay. So I, you know, one of the people I work with sort of noticed it, you know, and I said, I'm going to go speak to this person. You know, it's fine. And it was beautiful because I was able to leave the office. The person had left for the day, called him on his cell phone, and just said, that completely freaked me out. And the gift is, this is somebody who, frankly, I've been building a pretty active resentment towards. I've diagnosed quite a bit of his behavior. I don't know if he is alcoholic, but boy, he sure reminds me of some of my friends. And I was really like, wow, you know, I know he has his good qualities, but I'm so glad that I don't have to work with him as much as some of the other people. And he was beautiful. I mean, he was immediately apologetic. He was so sorry that I had had the intense reaction that I did and promised me it wouldn't happen again and thanked me for letting him know, you know, because you don't know if nobody says anything. But what was shocking to me is that after I got up the phone, I burst into tears. And I spent a good part of that night crying. And crying about the fact that that the danger in the past has been real. And being embarrassed that I had outed myself as somebody affected by this disease. And also sort of horrified because I would love to lay the blame for my reaction at the feet of my childhood, where there was some physical abuse, but with me it was mostly the threat of it. I always believed it was imminent. And that the only reason my head had not actually been pushed through a wall is I know what's required of me in that situation. I remember once at 11 or 10, my brother going off, and I had that strange moment of clarity that I had periodically as a childhood where I would sort of note, like, this is not normal. And one of the things I realized is that I had a mental checklist in terms of how to respond in those situations. Am I out of his path? Yes. Am I making eye contact? No. Am I smiling nervously? No. Do I know where it is, whatever he was looking for, his keys, his stash, his money? You know, and I thought, wow, this has happened a lot for me to know, you know, kind of like, you know, emergency preparedness kind of situation. And but you know what has been shocking to me is about a year ago I had to let go of a relationship that I really thought like finally I was going to get mine, my own version of happily ever after. And I think it's actually the first time I dated somebody who genuinely wanted to be with me. I know that sounds like it should be a baseline, but it's taken me a while to search for that. And we had a lot of love, but it was somebody who was dealing with some really big demons in their life. And as a result of what they were struggling with, I put myself in physical harm, in the way of physical harm. And what is shocking to me about that situation is it took me 6 months of us no longer being together to even feel the fear. Because I was so aware, watching this person dance with the darkness and working so hard to come through the other side, that all I could see was his pain. And to be fair, I did have a prayer, and throughout that process of, I don't know if this is ever going to get better. I'm hopeful that it will. I'd like to be here when that miracle happens. But I kept praying for God to show me if it was coming at too high a price. And that prayer was answered. This person suffered from severe nightmares and was screaming one night, and I was in the other room, and at 3 a.m., I remember thinking to myself, well, the alarm will go off at 7, and can I just hold out for 4 more hours? And this still, quiet voice said, you do that, and you're causing yourself harm. And I was able to, you know, get up, leave in the middle of the night, and go take care of myself. And that was pretty much the beginning of the end. And I had several miracles like that, including a brief time where we had contact again and this incredible outpouring of love and how much we'd like to be a part of each other's life. And I went on a long walk with God, and my sponsor tells me this frightening thing. She says, it's important to pray, and it's good to pray, but you have to want the answer. And the reason that terrifies me is it implies to me that I have the power to stand in God's way and block God's message, and I can obsess about that ad nauseum. So, but I think I know what she's talking about, which there comes a point of willingness that is different. And one of the things that happened is I went on this long walk, and I talked to myself, so I've transferred that into talking out loud to God, and I do it a lot. And I was on this walk saying, I love this person, but I don't know if we're any good for each other. And I don't know if this is insane for me to think that only a few months later that anything could be different. And I'm really willing to know your will for me, even if it means saying goodbye to this person. And by 7 o'clock that evening, something had happened that made it very clear to me that no, you know, the most loving thing he can do is to let go of me, and the most loving thing I could do back was do the same. But it has been frightening for me to see how little I value safety. I have been able to set boundaries in my life around the children I know that I would never occur to me to set for myself. And what I realized is that I have an assumption of grace around my nieces and nephews. They're entitled to that. You don't talk to a little girl like that. And you don't get scary and you don't threaten them. And I have been able to be that strong person for them as needed. But I have a lot of pride about the insanity I grew up with. And I have this vision of myself as a badass. It's never been real, but but I aspire to that. And I have definitely had this, like sort of that like cool by association, like you know, I'll be a badass by association, and it's been an interesting phenomenon where I have a brother who, frankly, I'm afraid of. And one of the things that I think is fascinating is when I date somebody, part of it is always, could they take my brother in a fight? Because if you can't do that, really, what use are you to me? So it's strange. And one of the things I realized a year ago when I was finally getting honest about the fear that I had been living in and the danger that I had been putting myself in, and I had this epiphany of like, oh, there is a level of fundamental safety and security that I want as a baseline in my life, that I want as the constant. And what was odd about it is when it first came to me, I was embarrassed by that. When I first went to my sponsor and I said, like, is it okay that this is what I really want? Like, I don't want to be that person who can take it, who isn't as scared, who's like, don't worry, you know, detox on my couch, I'll clean up, it's fine, you know? It's been just sort of surprising to me that I didn't know that I was entitled to that. So I'm reworking a lot of my assumptions. One of the things I had the opportunity to do is I truly had come to believe in this fellowship that there were sick people out there who simply haven't found the 12-step program that they belong into, and there are those of us lucky enough to be in recovery, and pretty much nothing in between. And I recently finished a graduate program, and one of the things I got to observe is, yeah, you know, there were your tweakers and your alcoholics and your Al-Anons, and then there were some normies, and they're not perfect. I mean, I think they can still be neurotic and, you know, have their issues, but what I saw is I saw a different definition of what a man is, and I realized that I was going to open AA meetings and listening to some AA speakers and really kind of liking this bad boy idea of what it means to be a man. And I got to see men who worked their entire school schedule around the fact that 2 days a week they were the one responsible for caring for their children. And they did it, and they did it out of love and joy and an honest desire to be there. And I currently work for a man, and it's fascinating to me because he's an acknowledged agnostic, and I think there's a generousness of spirit in that he's not convinced he's right. He calls me a woman of faith, which I think is a high compliment and something I hope I live up to. But so we have these incredible conversations, and I'm struck by the fact that here is a man who appears to do the right thing simply because it's the right thing and not just because he's going to die if he doesn't. And it's been really wonderful for me to have these other examples of how to live. I'm a big believer that there's not enough focus in Al-Anon on step one, so I'm probably going to talk about that a little bit. And it's probably not talked about a lot because it's difficult. It's always evolving for me. I came into Al-Anon at 17 because my brother had overdosed, and it's been his great gift to me. I consider him one of my primary motivators in this program. And he's been sober at times, and I'm grateful for those times because it's enabled us to share our experience with God together. I believe he's currently drinking now. But it forced me into the rooms, and it forced my mom into sobriety. And my first step initially in Al-Anon was just, this is too big. This is too scary. All those things that I read about were just sort of coming to the surface. And my emotions were bigger than I could contain. And the only time that I could catch a breath was in an Al-Anon meeting. And I think I went to Al-Anon for the first 4 years solely for that, so that once a week I could... and then try to function the rest of the time. And I did learn some very valuable survival skills, like if you're fighting with somebody on the phone and you want to get off the phone, it helps to hang up. So, you know, and I started watching alcoholism, and I was laughing with some people about lunch, which is, you know, once you acknowledge that this is what you're dealing with, alcoholism, it is actually incredibly predictable. And you sort of know that people will show up 2 hours late for Thanksgiving because they had to spend the previous 4 hours drinking enough to show up at your house, because you're not going to have enough alcohol. I mean, I don't stock my fridge the way they need it stocked. So, so it's interesting. I talk a lot with my sponsees about one of the trickiest things in Al-Anon is to identify where the bars are, because it doesn't look like a bar to us. You know, my drink has a lot to do with my relationship with alcoholics, and so the bars for me is Thanksgiving. I mean, that's one of those situations, like, I have to make sure that I have a fit spiritual condition before I spend any time with my family, especially if somebody's going to be drinking. That's a classic. So, but my step one has evolved, and it's taken me a long time to realize what makes me bodily different from my fellows, and one of my favorite pieces of literature is the book Alcoholics Anonymous, but I love the doctor's opinion because I love spending some time with, have I ever had a phenomenon of craving? And I grew up in a household where alcoholism is encouraged. It's what we did together. It's the only thing we did together. It was how, as a family, we shared. It was the only time we communicated. The only way we talked about God is if somebody was tripping. I mean, it was that, and I had a household where, mom was upset when my brothers got busted dealing drugs at high school, and she was upset because she told him when she gave him the drugs, don't deal it at school. So it's been interesting because professionally I work often with prison systems and people who have wound up incarcerated. And I was trying to communicate with some of the people I work with who really don't understand why some people get to the extremes they get around alcoholism and drug use. And I was trying to describe, like, do you have any idea the effort it took for me to not join in? Like, that's where everything was flowing. Everything was flowing towards join us. When I was 10 years old, everyone was getting high together, and it was drugs and alcohol together. And they passed the joint to me, and I passed it to the next person without taking anything. And the comment literally was, isn't she adorable? It's a phase. She'll grow out of it. So this is, you know, what we did. And yet, that never worked for me. I mean, if it ever, quite honestly, I mean, I'm sort of surprised when I listen to some AA speakers. I don't know what took you so long to find the alcohol. The first time I was drunk, I was 6. It just never fixed me. I mean, if it had ever given me peace, if it had ever made me taller, stronger, smarter, you know, fearless. I mean, if I had been able to get courage through that, I probably would be in the other room. It simply never fixed anything. But what I had instead is I had a mother who would look at me and say, honey, if it wasn't for you, I would have committed suicide years ago. And that worked. That made me feel like I had a purpose. That made me important. It was terrifying, but I was awfully good at it. And I continue to be really good at it. And that, for me, is my phenomenon of craving. I can do it anywhere. I can do it in my friendships. I can do it at my job. I really want to be the superstar. Frankly, if I can't be the star, I usually don't play. And, you know, it's there, but the place where it takes me to my knees is around alcoholics. I had a friend once, and she was describing it better than anyone I've ever heard. And what she said is, she said, you know, the alcoholic's sphere of attention, sober or drinking, only extends about this far. But every now and again, they look up and they make eye contact, and it's like laser beams into your soul. I went, yeah. That I understand. And that is what all of the behavior that I've done that I had to make amends for spawned from. How do I make myself indispensable to you so that you won't leave? This man that I was in a relationship with, I truly believed that if I wasn't sitting there reflecting back to him, the man that I know, the strong, capable person that I could see he was struggling to be, that he would just kill himself. I mean, it was so clearly a daily struggle to show up. And I was never asked to do that, but that's been my job for a long time, and there's security in that. My sponsor said it years ago, before I had the courage to ask her to sponsor me. She said, you know, people fall in love and out of love. She's like, I can kind of take it or leave it. Give me need. Need is job security. And that's, you know, I need to be needed. And I go to great lengths to feed that dependency, because I am dependent on you. There's an old-timer in Al-Anon who said that years before these terms like codependency were adopted by the treatment centers, that what they called it in Al-Anon when she started maybe 40 years ago was switching gods. And at its core, that's what I do. My mom was my higher power as a child, and to this day, I can give the alcoholic of the moment that power, unasked. I recently had an experience this fall where my brother left a nasty voicemail on my machine. And there was grace in that, too. I have to tell you, I mean, it's sometimes so quiet. But I saw it was him, and something went, let him leave a message. Now listen to the message, and two things happened that for me are miracles. I deleted the message. I didn't listen to it 8 times and play it for my sponsor and a couple of my program friends. I also took a deep breath and prayed. Basically, what he accused me of is being mean to his kids and that they didn't want to spend time to me anymore. And I love his kids. I wish I don't have children of my own. Instead, I have the loner babies. And they're the bright spot of my life. And I could have called him with the truth and used the truth as a weapon. And the truth as a weapon is, this has nothing to do with me. I don't know whether you're hungover or strung out or who you're really mad at, but take it to someone else. But it's one of those, would you rather be right or happy? And I really love those kids. So instead, I called him back, and I, you know, with a little bit of grace again, I got his voicemail, and the message I was able to leave was, I am so sorry to hear that. It breaks my heart, and I'm confused, because all I remember of when I saw your kids this week is how much fun we had. So clearly I missed something, and maybe we should talk about this. Never heard back from him. About a week later, I realized, you know, he never actually did say, don't pick my kids up from school, which was my job one day a week. So I left a message going, you know, I don't know whether that was implied, but let me know, because right now I'm still planning on picking them up. And we had an amazing conversation, which is he called me back, a little bit sheepish, explained to me he's dealing with a physical illness also, and he said, you know, I have a tendency to dial angry when I'm in pain, and it had nothing to do with you, and what I said was said, wasn't said. But he also went further, and I'm always stunned when, like, the alcoholic has pearls of wisdom and a little resentful that God chooses to use them. But we were talking, and I said, well, I'm so glad to hear that, because I know there have been times when I've been stressed at work or I've been impatient with the kids, but I've been really working on being present and leaving those worries, you know, at the office. And he said, you know, I have a feeling, because I always watch the kids with my mom's help. He goes, you know, I bet Nana doesn't do any of the discipline, and the kids are really sick of hearing it from you. And maybe it's just a case of tapping Nana on the shoulder and going, okay, I've told them to sit down twice. Now it's your turn. And what was amazing is he was right. It's exactly what had been happening. And I didn't realize how much of that, again, I had picked up unasked. And so, you know, I work constantly with my brother because I give him so little credit in my head to acknowledge the credit that he's due. So my step one is that I'm powerless over me, and that insane reaction, that desperate need to be seen, I actually got my sponsor because of my first relationship with a sober alcoholic. I've only ever dated sober alcoholics. It hasn't really improved the quality of my relationships much. But so I'm always sort of puzzled when Al-Anons are like, let me get a sober one. I'm like, okay. Okay, but first time that I did that, it was the first time that I got to see myself bringing that edge of violence into a relationship where my ex would say, you know, honey, I can't talk to you right now, I'm tired, I've got nothing left, I need to go, and I would be like, you must speak to me now. And I'm, you know, 5'1", and I like to date guys who are over 6 feet tall, and it's like, and I will make you hear me. And it really was this thing, and it was weird, because years later I had to make amends for rage, and used to accuse me of being angry, and I just thought, like, you've confused me with your ex-wife, and that's so unfair. And years later I was like, wow, you know, when I was screaming and forcing doors open, that probably looked a lot like rage. Because it didn't feel like rage. What it felt like is panic. It felt like if you walk away from this me in this moment, I was convinced I would die. So I have learned to just sit. I think it's one of the hardest things about my relationship with God is that I like to be told what to do. And God's directions to me often are sit in it. You know, it's where you are. I can't talk about God these days without talking about my other brother. My eldest brother, Tim, died what I consider to be an alcoholic-related death. It'll be 3 years in June. And the true miracle, I think, of Al-Anon is, first of all, I have to say, I have an enormous debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, they gave us their steps. I mean, that's just huge. Where would we be without that? But also, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me my mother. God willing, my mom will be clean and sober 19 years this summer. And she's my absolute best friend. And we hold each other accountable in this fellowship. At one time, I was sponsoring more people than her, and I used to tell her, don't worry, just keep showing up. Eventually, they'll want what you have. So our recovery is based on competition. But there's a way in which that's easy. We do speak a common language. We've been very blessed because there seems to have been a process where as each one of us has gotten ready, the other person to go deeper, the other person has too. So that's nice. I tell her on a regular basis, if you weren't working your program in every way that you do it, I wouldn't have you in my life the way that I do. You know, it's a veiled threat, but so it goes. But the real miracle for me in Al-Anon is how a relationship can heal without that. So my eldest brother is somebody who had no interest in not drinking. He never sought it out. It was not a problem for him. I thought it was a problem. I thought he'd have a better life if he didn't drink. I think he'd still be alive today. But it wasn't his choice. And he actually told me once, drunk, but sometimes people tell the truth when they're drinking. And what he said was, it is so nice to just be able to live my life and not have to constantly rationalize, defend, and explain. And I thought, oh, okay, I can do that. You know, I think one of the things that working the steps does is it prepares you to hear God's instructions. Even if people, I frequently have made amends where people have said, you know, oh, don't worry about it, I don't need the money back. And if I remain prepared, I find another way to pay them back or to make the amends. And the amends that I owed my oldest brother was I needed to learn how to be the baby sister again. I grew up feeling, I'm the youngest in my family, and I grew up feeling like the oldest. And my mom jokes all the time about how there was no adult in the house. And I was probably the first one to sort of take on some of those responsibilities. And so I continued to have sort of that, like, superior, almost big sister attitude to my big brother. And I needed to stop doing that. And I needed to start showing my big brother that adulation that I remember as a baby sister feeling of, like, these were my heroes. I just wanted to be like them when I grew up. And I started showing that in little ways, calling my brother and visiting with him and whatever he was doing, listening to, you know, his complaints about life, listening about his victories, and just showing him the love. And a couple of the miracles for me is, as I sort of referenced, you know, I grew up in a household where there was not only drug use, but drug dealing, and we had great pride about that. Our family value was the con. And if you can figure out a good enough con, like, that's how you make your way in the world. And we respected that, and that was what a lot of our pride was around. So, you know, drug dealers and thieves. And I grew up really wanting that also, you know, trying to figure out how I could work the situation, you know, system in any situation I was in. And in my home group, I'm often very sort of protective of my anonymity because I do live in a small town, and I know that there's like 2 degrees of separation within the rooms of people who know my family, and I try not to talk about what I do professionally. But it's such a powerful example of God's power in my life that I'm going to talk about it a little bit, and it ties into my brother. I'm an attorney, and I love it, and I can't tell you how amazing it is, and I could not do the job in the way that it's required of me without this fellowship, because I didn't know how to be honest and accountable. And for a lot of years, I thought people like me don't get to do that. that the most that I can expect to do is to live my life on the fringe. And I'll always just be struggling to survive. And I can't ever really be of the world and in the world. But law school was definitely God's idea. And when I went to take the tour, I talked to my eldest brother on the phone, and I went, "I'm terrified. And I'm terrified just to walk in. I don't even think I'm applying yet." I did the footwork. My understanding is God gave me this idea, but I'm going to do the footwork so that that door will be closed forever and God can direct me to what he really wants me to do. Because it's clearly not that. And instead, every door opened. And my brother said to me, "Honey, it's the first step of a major change. It must be terrifying." And I loved him for understanding that. And he was unbelievably proud of me. One of the burdens I placed on my brothers is I expected them to fill the void of my father who was never there. And they were always, they were only 7 and 9 years older than me, and it was an unrealistic burden to place on any child, let alone one struggling with their own addiction. But in the last 2 years of my brother's life, I got to see his pride in me. And he took me out to dinner when I got accepted to celebrate and to show me off. And just about 2 months before he died, we were on the phone, and I was telling on myself because he knew I was on Al-Anon, and I used to make jokes about program and my sponsees. And I was talking about how intense I get around school, that I could easily go without food or sleep, and my desperate desire to prove myself one more time, and kind of, you know, laughing about it. And he stopped me, and he said, "I'm so proud of you, and I'm envious. I'm envious because there are things that I want in my life that would require that kind of work, and I'm unwilling to do it. But I see that you are. And I'm so proud." And that was, you know, the last real conversation we had before he died. And I'm so grateful that I didn't spend the last 6 months of his life trying to get him sober or telling him what a disappointment he was or how I wished he was doing things differently. Because as much as I miss him, the one certainty I have is that I know that he felt the love I have for him. And that our relationship was totally healed, and we had these amazing conversations. I feel like one of the real gifts that we can give each other in recovery is to not need to all share the same truth. And we were talking once about mom being in recovery, and my brothers always found it baffling because they couldn't understand how mom could be an alcoholic when she drank so much less than them, which is really a good opportunity for me to practice. I do a lot of that. But he was saying once, like, "Wow, all I remember is how easy it was, that no matter how strung out and crazy and suicidal mom was, all I ever had to do was get her high and things got peaceful." And I wanted to, you know, what went through my head is, yeah, maybe that's because she was an addict. Oops. But instead what I said is, "I'm glad it was easy for you. I'm glad that that's your memory of it. I remember it a little differently." And he said, "I know you do." And he gave me that same gift about my dad. You know, my dad wasn't there for my growing up, but he had memories of him as a very angry stepfather, and I've only ever seen my dad raise his voice once. And I was able to say to my brother, "You know, I'm so sorry that that was your experience of my dad. I've only ever seen him angry once. It was intense, but it wasn't directed at me. And I feel safe with him." And he said, "I know you do, and I'm glad that you have that. That's as it should be." You know, so this is incredible to not have to make the point of who's right, what was it really like. I struggle, like I said, with my other brother, and I don't know what it's going to take to really heal that. I see God working on me in that relationship and taking me very reluctantly into looking at more some truth about myself. I had the opportunity one day a week for 5 years to take care of my nephews. And it was such a gift to my life. And I had a lot of stories I told myself about what I was giving them and a little bit of how much I was saving them. And I know the love was good and the love was important. But it also gave me this incredible opportunity to do nothing one afternoon except love and be loved. And that doesn't usually work its way into my schedule. So it was powerful. And one of the things I've been aware of for a couple years in Al-Anon is, you know, I've made formal amends to my brother once already. I'm in the middle of an inventory, and I'm sort of suspect I'm going to have to do it again at some point. But I've been saying, wow, one of these days I'm really going to have to stop calling his kids my kids. Like, you know, that's disrespectful. It dishonors the fact that he's their parent. So he just moved to Northern California, taking his family with him, and it was one of those moments of, oh, right. Well, thank you, God. I think I got it now. Because I wasn't consulted, I was informed. And it means I can't do any drive-bys, and I'm not there for a quick and ready rescue, which I really like to be, and I'm really having to get to another level of them being God's kids. And it's really where I struggle with God the most, because I'm pretty much willing to let most adults have their own experience and learn whatever they need to learn by any means necessary. But when it comes to the babies, I do want to rescue. I just think every child should never be afraid until the age of 18. And I know that's not how the world works, but I still tangle with God on that one. And what I'm trying to do is just learn how to show up and be a part of his family in a way that's respectful, and I'm still learning it. I want to talk briefly about amends because I think one of the reasons step one is so important is if you don't have a step one in Al-Anon, for one thing, I don't think you'll stay. I mean, I think the pain of the crisis that kicks you through the door will get you there a little bit for a while. I mean, it's certainly what got me in the rooms, but the only reason I've stayed is because I'm continuously reminded that I'm different, and it has nothing to do with being powerless over people, places, and things. There's actually quite a bit in my life that I'm effectively, that I do exercise power over. I dressed myself today. I got to this meeting on time, you know, and none of us have control over the weather, but that doesn't make me need a 12-step program. So I spend a lot of time, like I said, on step one, and part of that is because if I don't have a step one, I'll never do nine. I don't think anyone in their right mind would do nine if you didn't have to. And so I recently finished my last financial amends, and that was an incredible blessing. I used to clean houses for an elderly couple that had known me since I was 6 years old. And when I started to resent cleaning houses and needed a raise and was too afraid to ask for one, I just stole. And I had told them about it a few years ago, and they refused to take my money, which was good because actually at that time I didn't have it. But I was willing. And one of the things my sponsor has told me is that frequently we want to be we still want to retain our ego even in making amends. So we want to like sort of show up with three grand in singles, you know, and like throw it on the table. Boom. There's all the money I owe you. And I've had to make arrangements with people where it was, you know, $10 a month, 3 years. Because that's all I could commit to and not break the commitment. But I realized a year ago that I actually had the money that I owed them. And it was, you know, maybe 5 years since I talked to them. But I wrote a check and I included a note explaining I have this new profession and this is what's happening in my life and giving them a little update on my family. And I sent, I think it was $1,200 that I owed them. And, you know, they cashed the check. So that's always a good sign. And I got this lovely phone message back of, you know, how much they hadn't needed it, but that they were glad to hear that I was doing all right. And one of the things I realized about my stealing is I was a petty thief. You know, I never did anything spectacular. I didn't have a particularly long thieving career. But what happened for me is all of my stealing was about God doesn't have me. I'm not going to be taken care of. There's not enough. And somehow pocketing a $10 item would make me feel for half an hour, half a day that it was going to be okay. And what I realized is that I really didn't necessarily care about healing my relationship with Whole Foods or Hastings or any of these sort of like mega companies. That I made those financial amends because it was the demonstration to God that I believed he had me and that that kind of self-help was no longer necessary and that it was my commitment to him that I would no longer force a solution in that way. And I'm not going to be able to tell you about all the miracles. I have incredible relationships in my life today, and many of the relationships I have are relationships that I never even wanted. My dad's family has come into my life in an amazing way, and that was a result of making an amends where I met them all in Dallas once when I was 7 years old. And I had a resentment towards the entire clan based on the fact that they clearly don't care about me. And that was how I wrote it. And when I got through my inventory, my sponsor said, well, the first thing you have to do is you have to treat them like individuals. Who are these people? The second is, do you really want a relationship with them? And if you do, you have to initiate it. And what I did, and it took me an ungodly long time to do it. Like, I truly cannot, it's, like, I think I did that amends 10 years before I wrote the letters. I mean, I wrote that inventory 10 years before I finally wrote the letters to them, and I have no idea why it took that long, but I finally sent out the letters a few years ago, and it was sweet little things about, this is what I remember about you from that trip. I hope your life is good. Love you, thinking of you, Kate. I threw in a card with my contact information, expecting nothing. And what has happened is I have had this incredible outpouring of love. And last year I got to go to Galveston, Texas, where they do a family reunion every year. And very slowly through the course of this weekend, everybody made amends to me. And they made amends to me for not making the effort to get to know me. And they're just lovely people. And it's a whole family that has always been mine for the taking, and I didn't know it was there. What else? I can't think of anything else. I'm going to go ahead and close with this. Most people don't know that Al-Anon has our own version of the promises. We don't put them up in meetings enough. And you'll hear a similarity to the ninth step promises. And, you know, I'm a true believer that there are a lot of promises in our literature, far more than are usually acknowledged. I like the one about if they fail to enlarge their spiritual life, they will not survive the certain low spots ahead, something like that. It's kind of a barbed promise. It's as much a warning as it is a promise. But it's right. I find it comforting that there will be low spots ahead. That's been the nature of my recovery, is that I am asked to show up for life ever more, which means I have more relationships and I take greater risks, and there's a potential there for greater loss. It says, if we willingly surrender ourselves to the spiritual discipline of the 12 steps, our lives will be transformed. We will become mature, responsible individuals with a great capacity for joy, fulfillment, and wonder. Though we may never be perfect, continued spiritual progress will reveal to us our enormous potential. We will discover that we are both worthy of love and loving. We will love others without losing ourselves, and will learn to accept love in return. Our sight, once clouded and confused, will clear, and we'll be able to perceive reality and recognize truth. Courage and fellowship will replace fear. We will be able to risk failure to develop new hidden talents. Our lives, no matter how battered and degraded, will yield hope to share with others. We will begin to feel and will come to know the vastness of our emotions, but we will not be slaves to them. Our secrets will no longer bind us in shame. As we gain the ability to forgive ourselves, our families, and the world, our choices will expand. With dignity, we will stand for ourselves, but not against our fellows. Serenity and peace will have meaning for us as we allow our lives and the lives of those we love to flow day by day with God's ease, balance, and grace. No longer terrified, we will discover that we are free to delight in life's paradox, mystery, and awe. We will laugh more. Fear will be replaced by faith, and gratitude will come naturally as we realize that our higher power is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Thank you.